This is episode number 34 of the Big Web Show, Everything Web That Matters. This show is hosted by Jeffrey Zeldman and Dan Benchman. That's me. And this episode is sponsored by SourceBits, providing software design and development services for iOS, Android, Mac, and the web. SourceBits is at the bleeding edge of emerging technologies, and their deep experience and successful track record ensures that your idea, whatever it is, will be transformed into a functional, well-tested, and visually stunning world-class app in no time. Support the show. Check them out at sourcebits.com, cutting-edge app development, and by Campaign Monitor, email marketing software for designers and their clients. You can design great-looking emails using your own tools. So your own JavaScript, CSS, HTML, and whatever you want to do, you can do that. And you can manage your subscriptions with ease. And they've just released a brand new API. They have monthly pricing now, autoresponders, and more. You can sign up today at campaignmonitor.com. Jeffrey Zeldman, welcome back. How are you today, sir?
Fantastic. How are you, Dan?
Doing well, and we have a great guest. We've already been chatting a little bit in advance of the show for those who tune in live, but let's do it properly.
Right, let's do it properly. This is Craig Maude, which, you know, it's such a great name. Just right there. If you'd done nothing else, Craig, but be born and have that name, you'd already have done a fantastic thing, because Craig Maude is just a great name. It's a name for a spy, a secret agent, lead character in a novel. I mean, there's so many things that the imagination just Maude. My God, Maude, right? You got Maude. Not Maude like the TV show from the 70s with B. Arthur, but Maude like Mods and Rockers and all that great stuff. So, but rather than rest on the laurels of having an awesome name, Craig has, he's done many things. He's lived in Tokyo for 10 years. I'm not sure where he's from originally, but we'll find out. But he's not Japanese originally. He is co-author and designer of Art Space Tokyo, an intimate guide to the Tokyo art world. And over the past several years, Craig has been, I would say, in the lead, or one of the people, certainly, in the lead of trying to understand and define the changes that are happening to publishing. Well before the iPad came out, and certainly since it came out, even more so, Craig has been blogging at craigmaude.com and writing elsewhere as well about the form of the book and what it means when you have, you know, when you have a book where the user can change the typeface and size, and you may not be able to, and possibly the face, you may not be able to control the face, but you still want to, et cetera, all the things we know about. And yet you still want to create a good, solid, strong, powerful, wonderful, modern reading experience. You basically want to recreate the book in its new digital form. So he's been trying to tackle that. And this week he introduced Bibliotype, an HTML baseline typography library for tablet reading, released under an MIT license. It's open source, so people can mess with it. And he described what it was about and why he'd come to it in an article on A List Apart. But I know many people read that, and I'm sure some of people in our chat room will have questions about it. I'll have questions about it as well. And for the past, since October of 2010, you moved from Japan, from Tokyo, where the sun rises, to California, the Bay Area, where you are now working, where you've been working on helping, in your own words, helping sculpt the future of digital publishing with Flipboard. And I'm sure many of our listeners have Flipboard. It's a really wonderful app for the iPad. Basically brings all kinds of streams to visual life. And it could be a controversial app in that it's basically repurposing other people's publishing. But I don't know that there have been any, I don't know that anyone's complained. You recently, Flipboard introduced a whole lot of partnerships with magazines like Swimsuit Issue. Was that for some reason, that's all I remember. Oh, we're out of time. I'm sorry. I want to thank you for coming. No. Here we are, Craig Maud. A pleasure to have you here.
Welcome, sir. Welcome.
Good morning, gentlemen.
Yeah.
So with that kind of setup, I mean, it's, you know, where do we jump in? One of the things that I know Jeffrey and I both are fascinated with, and something that you've been specializing in, is, you know, the future. We talk about this all the time. It's almost a cliche to say, what is the future of publishing? What is the future of web publishing? But, you know, let's look at Flipboard as an example of this. This is an app that came out and has been incredibly successful. And in a lot of ways, I think pulls together and defines what we think of when we think of web publishing or publishing of data. So maybe we can talk about that. How involved were you in the creation of Flipboard and the idea of Flipboard and in its evolution? Is that something you can talk about?
I can talk about Flipboard as it is now, but I had nothing to do with its first release back in July. I was at the office visiting a friend, a really close friend of mine, Marcos Westcamp, who's the lead designer there, the only designer there. He's the guy who, you know, is responsible for how the entire app looks and the sort of the unique layouts and everything. I mean, Marcos's hand played a huge part in making Flipboard what it is. But I mean, I jumped in like a hired gun, this sort of hobo from Japan, flying in October to kind of, you know, just see what we could work on together. You know, it's when I went out there and met them in July. I mean, the team is just phenomenal. It's kind of one of the things that I think if you don't or if you have issues with what Flipboard is doing right now, or if you don't like the way certain things look, or you don't like the way some of the design acts, trust me, everyone in that office knows what's going on. I mean, it's like it's such a cliche to say, but some of the most talented people I've seen, and so that was, you know, that was one of the big pulls to come out. And
who are the other people? I'm sorry. Who are the other people, and what do they do? And then what's your role?
It's about 20 people now, a little over 20 people. There's quite a big, actually surprisingly big back end team. So there's a lot of analysis of what's coming in, coming through. You know, looking at articles, trying to understand what's happening in the articles that are being sent through the system, through the social networks. But the front end team is only a few developers, Troy and Evan, and Marcos is the only designer that was involved until I came in October. It was just Marcos doing everything, doing the website and doing all the layouts and the comps and the all the different iterations on the UI. I mean, if you ever meet Marcos, have him show you, and he has his iPad, have him flip through how many different iterations they went through on the Flipboard UI before getting to where they got. It's amazing. I mean, like thousands and thousands and thousands.
It was just an idea he had, and they launched it?
Mike McHugh and Evan Dahl are the co-founders, and they brought Marcos on, I guess last March or April, I think, and they had started working on it earlier before that.
Okay, and their background was content or development or finance, or you don't know?
Mike had been, he's kind of a serial entrepreneur. He'd done a couple of companies. His last company was Tell Me, which sold to Microsoft a few years ago. And then Evan was, I believe he was at Apple. He was one of the original guys on, Evan, I'm sorry if I'm getting this wrong. One of the original guys working on the iPhone, actually programming some of those, the core apps that you get when you get an iPhone, like in that first iteration. And then he was, I think, teaching a class at Stanford on iOS development. But just ridiculously talented people.
A lucky hack, basically.
Yeah, basically just fell into it. No talent.
So what did they say I mean, because there you are in Tokyo, you've got a whole scene going, and you're, were you independently employed at that time? Were you successfully working as a designer and writer and reporting to no one? Was that accurate? Or?
Basically, I mean, you know, I mean, that sums up my last 10 years, you know.
So what makes a freelancer? What makes a freelancer who's successful, who's living in one of the capitals of the world, this glamorous thing? Not that I'm not saying that the San Francisco area isn't fantastic, because it is, of course, but
slightly different.
What did they say to you, or what made you say, I'm giving up my freelance life and coming to be the second designer on this? What was it? What was it about the product or the people? You already talked about the people being awesome. So what was it about the product that made you say, yeah, this is what I want to work on?
Well, you know, I mean, this last year, it's been a really weird year. It's, you know, a year ago right now, I didn't have a job. I had actually decided, I was like, all right, 2010, I'm going to do no client work. That was my, I'd been able to save up a little money in 2009. And I was like, all right, I live, you know, and I guess this is, you know, anyone that I talk to is coming out of college, and they're like, they ask, how do you work on the stuff you want to work on? I say, minimize recurring costs in your life. So minimize like the cost of your apartment, don't have a car, don't spend money in stupid ways, basically. And believe it or not, living in Tokyo can be super, super cheap, like incredibly cheap. I was living in Tokyo on a ridiculously small amount of money. And so last year I wasn't under too much pressure to go out and get a job and I had all these ideas anyway, things I wanted to work on. The GF1 field test after I came back from Nepal was something I wanted to write. And then when that came out and it did well, and I put Amazon referrals on there, and I was just, you know, in 3 days, I think I made like $3,000 off of selling cameras.
All right. Back up for 1 second, just so people who don't know what you're talking about, what is the GF1 field test, and how did you make $3,000 in a day? Actually, you can skip the first question.
Tell us about the second one, please.
Well, we'll spend 100 hours writing a review for a geeky camera that no one else has really written a non-technical review for. I went to Nepal at the end of 2009, and I just bought this camera, the GF1 by Panasonic, and I kind of bought it on a whim, you know, whatever. Didn't really kind of needed a new camera, but mainly just wanted a new toy. And so went to Nepal, went on this long trek up into the mountains, and it was just an awesome camera. It was just really, really fun. And I was like, wow, this is, I haven't used a camera like this in a long time. I haven't had this much fun with a camera. I've been taking pictures for years and years. And so when I got back, I just, all right, let's write this up. Let's talk about this camera. It's too cool not to talk about. And it's really kind of one of those sort of ethereal things about like what makes a product good, right? I mean, it's like it does everything that other cameras do, but there's just something about the build quality and the way it functions and the photos you get out of it and the lightness. It's some sort of small combination of all these little little bits and pieces that make it just phenomenal.
Where would we see pictures you've taken with it?
You can go to my website and on the GF1 field test, you can see a bunch of photos there.
At craigmod.com.
At craigmod.com, yeah.
Yeah.
So I came back, wrote that up, put some affiliate links on there thinking I'm going to get maybe, you know, $20. And like $3,000 came in. You know, thanks in large part to John over at Daring Fireball linking. I mean, I think out of anyone that's ever linked to anything I've done, I think his readers are the most engaged. I mean, that's the impression I get. I don't know. I mean, you guys must see a lot of traffic too. And I've looked at the logs, and the people who come from Daring Fireball read longest. They click on more stuff. It's really, it's just impressive. It's a cool, you know, it's a great community he's built over there.
We hate John Gruber here at the show, but thank you for pointing that out.
You know, I mean, it's, I think you're right. I think that in the case of John, I think people may like or dislike what he has to say, but they trust that if he's going to link to something, it's going to be important. And these photographs, and I think that to me was always what struck me when I read this, is that it wasn't just a review. You could have just written a review, but you actually took some, and I'm showing them for the people who tune into the video can see this. I mean, these photographs in and of themselves, you didn't even have to talk about the camera. You know what I'm talking about. So, I mean, do you consider yourself to be a photographer as well? Are these the kind of results that, that an amateur should expect by picking up this camera and walking out? I mean, I'm not going to make this into a show about the camera, but obviously, I mean, there's a lot that goes into taking these kinds of shots. What's required? And then as a follow-up question, what inspired you to do such an in-depth article and do this in such a unique way? I mean, this looks like something from National Geographic.
It does.
Yeah. Actually part of the article too was just to get me to edit some of the photos. Cause I know that if I didn't say, all right, let's make a deadline and let's make a purpose for putting these photos together, they would have just sat in Lightroom for 6 months or something. So, I don't know. I wasn't really thinking about, how to make some sort of, beautiful presentation for the photos. It was just, there was something special both about that trip, which I kind of feel like sort of changed my life in a way, kind of refocused me. And there's a lot of energy that I got from that. And I was just like, Jesus, all right, we have to focus this into something. And so I guess when you have a lot of energy and you've just been to Nepal, you write, 3,500 words about a camera, which is kind of weird.
We were talking before the show about the little mark on your head on your avatar, your Twitter avatar. For those who go to twitter.com/CraigMod, there's a tiny little picture of Craig, and when you click on it, goes up to a big picture of Craig, and it's half his face, kind of like the Meet the Beatles, Kirsten Asher, the photographer who originally photographed the Beatles in Germany in like the early 60s, who got that half in shadow thing that they then used over and over again. But Craig's done this with his face, and there's this blotch on his head, this colored blotch. It almost looks like some kind of strange JPEG artifact. But you were telling me the story. It's actually the mark that a homeless man in Nepal put on your head. So your avatar, it's like you're permanently marked. You say it's changed you, but like the way people encounter who you are, if they look there, there's this red mark on your head. And the guy just walked up to you in a rice field, right? A rice paddy, and said, did he say anything? Do you speak Nepalese? What happened?
No, I don't. I was with... I hired a guide sort of at the last minute when I got there, and we became really close. I mean, just sort of like brothers. He was like 22, 23, and so I ended up in that field in sort of that village because he invited me to come back and stay with his family, and so it was with him that we encountered the sort of the homeless wandering priest, and he said something.
Priest,
but he was homeless.
Kind of
he was a homeless priest. Yeah, exactly. It was like a blessing.
Is he a Buddhist priest? Because that's often true that they have no material.
Right.
They just wander and get taken care of somehow.
I think he was, because in Nepal there's sort of a. It's actually pretty cool the amount of kind of confluence that happens between Buddhism and Hinduism in Nepal. So I think he was more on the Hindu side of things. It felt like a blessing. I have this thing on my wrist too from that trip. And that
on your wrist, you got a tattoo too.
This is to even if I'm sitting here in Palo Alto, California, it's to remember. What set all of this in motion? Like, I'm sitting here today because I went on that trip and sort of the weird stuff that happened after that. So
how did you pick Nepal? You're like, I'd like to do something like that. Wouldn't occur to me. It's like, I just got a new iPhone. I think I'll go to Nepal. That wouldn't happen. How did you pick Nepal? Had you always wanted? Are you a longtime Asian traveler? Family background from Asia? What's going on?
Well, you know, when you live in Tokyo, it's super easy to go to Asia. It's like, you know, 3 hours to get to China. It's like an hour and a half to Korea. So I'd done sort of a 40-day trip through Tibet in central China, and Tibet is phenomenal. Tibet is just amazing. But it's also really hard to get into because the Chinese government will sort of turn on and off visas, and you can never really plan a trip to Tibet. And so I was thinking, geez, I'd really like to go back to Tibet to do more photographing. I'd like to go to the west. I kind of went north in Tibet, went hiking up to some glaciers, but I'd like to go west towards Everest. And then I thought, well, I could just go to Nepal and then not have to deal with all of the sort of Chinese issues with visas and worrying about getting in or moving around in the country. And so I just kind of randomly ended up in Kathmandu. Hadn't planned anything. Bought the ticket three weeks before I left. And then just went, bought some gear and went to Kathmandu, spent a night in Kathmandu, which is one of the craziest places I've ever been. You know, it's kind of, oh my God, the amount of, sort of traffic. And anyone who's been to Mumbai, I'm sure is going to laugh at me because it's nothing compared to that, but I've actually never been to India. So, but for me, it was, Jesus, Kathmandu was by far the kind of most intense, really polluted, you know, cars sort of running into each other, a lot of chaos. So I got out of there really quickly and just went right up to the mountain.
So let's back up one just a little bit further. Did you go to Tokyo originally for college or for a job or a relationship, or how did you end up? I'm assuming that you're American or maybe British. I don't know.
Yeah, no. I grew up in Hartford, actually, around Hartford,
there
Connecticut.
You go. That explains the British thing.
Yeah, yeah. Very, very similar to Tokyo in absolutely no way. And so when I was 19, I just wanted to. I wasn't really having fun at university here, and I thought two options. All right, Maude, you got two options. One, you can move to San Francisco and do startup stuff. This is like in 1999. Or let's go to Japan. Why not? You know, you can just go and you know, I figure there's no, Japan's the kind of country that if you don't go with kind of a plan, if you don't go saying, all right, I'm going to go to university, and do a homestay, then it'd be difficult to get into the culture. So I got into a university and, I was able to do a homestay, and I went when I was 19, and it was just a really fun, surreal experience. So I left, and then when I went back about a year later, I went back for a band, actually, sort of for a woman, but more for music. I was a drummer.
You told her it was more for her.
I told her it was for her. Yeah. But it was for the music.
Yeah. So
it's good. What kind, was it like punk rock or?
It was. I studied
hip-hop,
jazz for a while.
Fusion,
I was.
Jazz.
It was like a Japanese sort of like your blood flying everywhere sort of punk rock wild thing. Yeah.
Were you the
it was
only?
Fun. It was fun.
Were you the only Occidental?
I was. I was. The token white drummer.
That's because white drummers have the funk. That killed everything.
Okay. I have a question for you about this. Do you notice any inspiration from going to a different place and then coming back to your sort of home base and starting over with a different vibe? In other words, a lot of people will tell me that they love traveling because they draw a lot of inspiration from it in whatever it is that they do. But you didn't really just travel here. I mean, you completely relocated. You went to a completely different country. Do you think that affected or inspired you in some way or changed the way that you viewed the work that you do?
Oh, I mean, absolutely.
How does a different place affect you in that way?
God, you know, first of all, it's really frustrating, you know, living in a country like Japan that, especially when you first get there, you don't know, you know, it's a challenge every day. It's sort of, you're being rubbed the wrong way. You know, it's kind of like, you're rubbing a dog, you know, backwards on its fur. All these little things that just kind of get to you. And so you have to kind of like, you're constantly working. And then obviously the language, the cool thing about learning a new language and becoming functionally fluent in it, and dreaming in it, and sort of not having to translate things you want to say into it, is that it definitely makes you think differently. You know what I mean? Like when I speak Japanese, it's a different, something in here is functioning differently than when I'm speaking English. And that's kind of cool. And so, you know, things like that definitely, they influence and they inform, I think, your aesthetics. And then, I mean, geez, just living in Japan, I lived in the equivalent of a large American walk-in closet.
Wow.
For last 8 years, I guess. It was small, like 20 square meters, maybe. So what is that? You know, like 200 square feet, something like that. Wow. Really, really small. So that affects the way you think about acquiring material goods. Like, I just don't have much. So actually coming out here, living in Palo Alto now, so getting back to Jeffrey's original question about what kind of inspired me to be able to come, is that, you know, I mean, it's super easy. I didn't have to bring anything. You know, I've got like, all I own is books. If I didn't have books, I'd have pretty much everything I own could fit into about two bags. So,
and soon, except for art books, all your books can be on a device.
See how I brought that around to the books?
Well, so, we should talk about the books.
Yeah, please. Let's do that.
I mean, you, before we even talk, your website is very art directed, or you're one of the people, along with Jason Santa Maria, where every time you write a post, there's something different going on visually. Sometimes you push that really hard, sometimes not so much, but you know, there's a basic grid and basic typographic choices and everything. And then you play to some extent, and it's like reading a magazine or something. So in your website, you were bringing kind of a print magazine sensibility to blog posts, right? Several years ago. So now you're on the flip side of that, trying to work with book-like, and you're also the author of a traditional book. By traditional, I just mean a book with a publisher, and it's printed, and volumes are bound. Or did you self-publish with Kickstarter?
Two different ways. Originally, ArtSpace Tokyo came out with Shin Music Press, which was, it's in a way, I guess it's like self-publishing, because that was a company that I helped get going. The second time was with Kickstarter. Totally self-published, self-distributed. All sort of done grassroots style. And extremely satisfying, like a really satisfying process.
And what are you doing with digital books now? Are you exploring this form as a writer? Are you exploring it as a designer?
Good question. Yeah, I mean, because I haven't actually done any, you know, I mean, I haven't done any digital books really. And it's been, you know, something I've been thinking about. And right now, I'm working with someone to help get to sort of experiment a bit and take ArtSpace Tokyo into kind of a, you know, a next generation EPUB style thing. So that's kind of being worked on right now.
Simple Scott did the Designing Obama.
Mm-hmm.
You know that book, right?
You're familiar with the book? I do.
And then he did a digital version of it as an app. Right, mm-hmm. It's not a PDF exactly. Mm-hmm. It's some kind of web app, which preserves the look and feel of the book exactly.
Right.
And it's gorgeous. And you know, I bought it. It's a gorgeous thing. But I guess I'm curious how you feel about that kind of hybrid, or if that's where you think, if that's the direction digital books should be going, or is that an exceptional kind of a one-off case, an edge case? how do you feel about things like that, and versus HTML and all the, you know, all the trade-offs that we web designers have been dealing with for 15 years now, like all the things you can't control. Designing books, it's given and keeping in mind all the things you can't control in HTML.
Well, I mean, I think that's the interesting thing about what's happening with HTML, is that we can control more and more now, right? It's sort of, I mean, would you agree, Jeffrey?
Yeah, definitely. There's still always user choices that can change things, and there's still always,
right,
with, you know, browser or device, somebody comes along and says, this device is, you know, it's going to use the Opera browser, but it's going to use the Opera 9 browser. Oh, and the resolution is three times what anyone has had before. And so all of a sudden you've got a pixel has a different meaning and all that. So there's still unknowns.
Right.
You know, as opposed to, you know, with traditional book publishing, the only unknown is will they accidentally get too much ink on the plates, you know, will they print on cheaper paper later? That's about it.
Right. Did the end pages glue to the, you know, I had one guy talking about sort of book disasters. We had one book that we did and we always, when I was with Chin Music Press, we were always putting, I'm sorry, is this microphone popping a lot?
I think it's just maybe a little close.
Okay.
It's a little close.
So one of the books that we worked on was, this book about New Orleans, and we had it printed in, I'm not going to say where, cause I don't want to embarrass them, but we had bookmarks sewn in, bookmarks, like these cloth bookmarks put in, which is kind of like a nice thing, right? You know, it's like, you always have a bookmark. And they had glued it in. So this isn't a book, but you can imagine. So the bookmark was flush with the bottom of the book. So you couldn't actually see the bookmark. So it was kind of a worthless bookmark. So I got the sample. They sent me a sample. And I said, can you not do that in the final edition? And apparently they had already printed all the final editions. Because when we got them, all of the bookmarks had been, they must have hired some sad sap to go in and like physically kind of like pull, because the bookmarks are actually glued down the spine. So pull the bookmarks out and then replace them. So they're hanging out by about this much. And what that meant is that all of that glue that hadn't dried yet stuck inside of the books. So when everyone who bought those books, we apologize, but all of the pages were, they all had pages glued together, and you ended up having to rip your bookmark out of the book, which is, you know, in a different context could be very cool, but it wasn't what we were going for.
Whereas with a digital book, the problem is I don't know what the bookmark means, and I keep on hitting the bookmark, and then I realize that it's like, does this mean I've saved this page? The first time I used the bookmark feature in iBooks, I thought I was leaving a bookmark to remind myself where I'd been so I could start there again. And each time I would stop, I would leave a bookmark. It turned out that I was actually highlighting those random pages as if I found them interesting. It wasn't really a bookmark. We're using the sign of the bookmark, but we're meaning something else by it. And
I think that's a good point. Maybe a lot of this, you know, a lot of the terminology that we're using for these new books doesn't make sense. What is a table of contents? This is kind of, you know, something that we've been having a discussion about lately, even at Flipboard, is, you know, what is a table of contents? What is like a modern, what does a contemporary table of contents look like? What purpose does it serve, and like how can it be augmented in ways that add value that aren't obnoxious? I think that's like that, you know, that's a really important question. How can you augment, digital books? How can you add things to books brought into a digital form that doesn't annoy people or get in the way of the reading process, or, in other ways, you know, obstruct that sort of flow of just like going through the text. But at the same time, be right there, you know? So when you do need to do something X or highlight or whatever, take a note, it's really seamless. Do either of you guys, Dan or Jeffrey, do you have physical Kindles? the new Kindle?
Yeah, I do. I have both the first and the second generation Kindle here. The new smaller, I guess charcoal colored one, and the one that came before that.
What do you think of that,
Tim? Okay, go ahead.
I was just going to ask what do you like it? I mean,
I love it. I mean, as picky as I can be about some things, when it comes to something like a Kindle, I don't expect a whole heck of a lot out of it. I want a very, very clear screen that I can read in sunlight or in any light. I want to be able to turn the pages and that's about it. I don't ask a lot, but I absolutely love the Kindle. I realize to me, it's like the Kindle is for everything that I would want to read in a novel or traditional book format. I don't expect multimedia from it. I don't expect to get, technical diagrams or a lot of the things that you would find in what I would call a beautiful book, opposed to a text book. If it's text, I'm completely happy with the Kindle, but I don't even try to do things that kind of fall outside of that. Does that make any sense?
Totally.
Doesn't the full justification bug you? Kindle on the iPad and iPhone, there are books that I bought that I actually can't read because...
Full justification.
Yeah. I mean, on the phone, I have to set the type so tiny to make... And it's still like there's huge gaps everywhere and it looks terrible. But you know, it's like the measure... I mean... It's really not set up for reading. That's what bugs me more than anything. If they would just allow me to turn off justification, to turn off full justification, I would, that's my only real problem with it.
I understand. I'm totally with you there. I don't like full justification either. I mean, decades upon decades ago when I was in college, I was a technical writer and that was my degree. And even back then they said, don't use full justification. It's terrible. I agree. I mean, that's horrible, but for what I get from the Kindle, the portability of it, the amazing battery life, being able to download samples of books and read them and then purchase them. And those things I can deal with the justification. And I think maybe it's because I'm a little more separated from the typography than somebody like you, Jeffrey, who's literally focusing on this kind of thing every single day. And I can just sort of swallow the medicine and say, all right, I get all these other great things from it. I'm willing to make this one concession and say, all right, I'll deal with this for all of this other stuff that I get. But this can't be the future of publishing, can it, Craig? I mean, this can't be what the rest of the world is going to, this is temporary, right? This is a stepping stone, right?
Oh, what do you mean? The Kindle or bad hyphenation?
Both.
Yeah. Well, I mean, and that's the funny thing. I think it's funny it frustrates you, Jeffrey, because it's like, I feel like we've been, working on the web with typography for so long. We've had to kind of just not see things, choose to not see the badness of web typography for a long time. As you and many others have been pushing to kind of fix it. So when I look at the Kindle, I'm with, like Dan's saying, you see all these, you get all these other great benefits. And at the same time, you can kind of go, all right, well, full justification options and also hyphenation options are going to come in eventually, kind of like with iBooks just brought, Right Rag in, I think, in a recent version.
Yeah, it made all the difference.
Yeah.
It's the only reason I prefer to read in that format now.
Well, you know what's interesting about a device like the Kindle, if you're talking about the future of books, future of publishing, is and to bring this kind of back to a country like Nepal. Actually, one of the reasons why I went was because there's this great nonprofit called A Room to Read, run by, I believe, James Wood. I think that's his name. He wrote a book, Leaving Microsoft to Change the World. And the long and short of it is that he starts libraries all over Southeast Asia and now I think Africa, and sponsors
women's education and stuff. But I mean, the main focus of A Room to Read is getting books to libraries in countries that don't have books, right? So like in a country like Nepal, where, you know, three books is like, you know, it's like finding a treasure. You know, he was stocking entire libraries over there. So I think, you know, talking about the Kindle, a device like this, the thing that's really exciting is, you know, now it's like, what, $140 and you get a Kindle? You know, how long before this iteration of the Kindle is, you know, can be sold for $30 or $40, you know, the cost of a couple books. And right now, you know, the current Kindle, you turn off Wi-Fi and you get, what, like a month of battery or like a couple weeks of reading time. It's pretty impressive. So when you take those considerations into account, those features, and you think, okay, it's going to get better, you know, as in the next couple of years, it's going to get cheaper. The battery is going to last longer. You know, we'll be able to put programs in place to help publishers donate digital editions of their books. So you can go to a country like Nepal, and you can go to villages, and you can give them a Kindle-like device. And instead of, you know, the logistics of getting physical books to remote villages is like you have to rent a donkey. That's a big part of it, is renting a donkey. Because there's no roads, and so you put books on a donkey, and then you go up the mountain, and then you get the books to the kids. But if you can just take a Kindle and start bringing, you know, a loaded Kindle full of an entire library to these villages, and you can imagine solar powered devices, you know, recharging them, and they don't take much energy to recharge, and the battery lasts a long time. I don't know, it's pretty exciting. So when you know, we're talking
about... Yeah, that's
about,
really beautiful. That's so inspiring.
Well, you know, when we talk about the future of the book, I mean, that's the kind of stuff that, for me, is really exciting. That's like, you know, suddenly how do you get... You know, we talk about accessibility of, to libraries and books and whatnot, but it's like you're talking about, you know, forget one laptop per child. If you can get a Kindle-like device to, you know, a village in Africa... you know, or the remote mountains of China or something, you know, that's a very powerful thing. And the cost of that is quickly approaching, you know, a trivial cost, which is cool. That's really cool.
I want to go out on that because I think what you've just talked about is very important. So unless there's anything else.
No,
you
I think
like
that's a great place to end it. Craig, where can people go to find out more about you and read your writing, see more of your pictures?
Just go to my homepage, craigmod.com.
All right. Craig Mod on Twitter?
Mm-hmm. Craig Mod.
Craig, thanks so much for joining us today. It was
great. Thank you so much today. And
yeah, thank you guys.
You'll be in New York next week giving a free lecture, I believe.
I will, yep.
Can people find out about that from craigmod.com as well?
No, actually, yeah. Under speaking at the top, it's going to be at the School of Visual Arts next Wednesday, I think from 6 to 8. And if you, I don't know if there's any space left, but if you really, really, really want to go, send me an email and I can probably, sneak you in. So let me know. And I'll talk much more about, the guts of digital books instead of, you know, hiking in Nepal so much.
Well, thanks again, Craig, for being on the show. Thanks, Jeffrey.
Thanks for having me.
Have a good trip. And thanks to everybody who tuned in today. We really appreciate it. Thanks to our sponsors, sourcebits.com and campaignmonitor.com for making this possible. Thanks to wistia.com for hosting the video. Thanks to mailchimp.com for sponsoring the bandwidth for the show. Thanks to all of you for listening and rating the show on iTunes, and check out 5x5.tv for previous episodes of this show and all the other shows that we do. And we'll see y'all again right here next week.
Bye-bye.